Here's what I want to cover in our time together today. I want to now move into what I'm going to call kind of the nuts and bolts of the deacon's work in the congregation. And obviously, I cannot hit on every aspect of that. But I do want to touch on the concept of what is stewardship. How do we teach the congregation about stewardship? And then I want to touch on probably one of the biggest pitfalls for individuals as well as families, and that's finances, and how the deacons can be of immeasurable help to the congregation in terms of finances. And I have we don't give handouts in the PCA, so I have some outlines up here, some stuff to give to you as we begin. I'm going to start by talking about how we can instruct the congregation about biblical stewardship, and then I'm going to talk about how we can instruct the congregation in terms of sound biblical financial principles, and then I'm going to close with a quick talk on how we can work together with the elders. I'm going to start by making a reference to Genesis chapter 39 in the verses 1 through 4. And what we find there is the narrative of Joseph being brought into Potiphar's house. And the fourth verse is especially instructive because it reads this way: Potiphar made him his personal attendant and put him in charge of his household, placing in his hands all that he owned. We find the same thing that Abraham did with Eliezer. He was his first steward. He was the man who was in charge of everything, really, all the physical possessions that Abraham owned. And it's instructive, I think, that in Genesis 15:2, Eliezer is then called there literally the son of possession. So what does that mean? Well, the upshot, I believe, of what we're taught in the Old Testament in the case of Potiphar and Joseph is that the steward owns nothing, but he governs everything. He owns nothing, but he governs everything. We know from many of the narratives of the Lord Jesus, the parables that talk to us often about stewards. And a steward is from the Greek oikonomos. And that basically means a house manager or an administrator. Interestingly, the word for steward, oikonomos, is the word from which we derive our English word economics. So he's a foreman, he's a governor. And the Apostle Paul, writing in 1 Corinthians 4, 1 and 2, says this: "This is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover," verse 2 he says, "it is required of stewards that they be found trustworthy." That, I believe, is a clear indication of what we're supposed to be about as those who are stewards of what the Lord Jesus Christ has entrusted to our care. We own nothing, and yet we govern everything that God entrusts into our care. And one of the most important lessons that we can teach the various congregations that we represent and that we serve is that God has made man a steward of his created order. Obviously, there are clear texts that relate to this. Genesis 1, 26 through 28. "And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. They shall rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the cattle, the whole earth, and all the creeping things that are on the earth. And God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fertile and increase, fill the earth and master it, and rule the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and all the living things that creep upon the earth." Many theologians call that the creation mandate. In other words, what we have there is this concept of dominion that man, created in the image of God, is to have. And that dominion, as we read through the first three chapters of Genesis, relate to labor, marriage, and Sabbath keeping. So in terms of our dominion, it's a very simple thing. We are indeed to exercise dominion over the earth that God has entrusted into our care, not to abuse it, but to use it rightly. And then in the eighth psalm, we are reminded of these words, "Yet you have made man a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet." And so it is with our concept of being a good steward. Now, I mentioned this morning that in our directory for public worship, in chapter 54, two sections, 1 and 2, we are given a very clear indication of what we are supposed to be doing. And the title of chapter 54 is "The Worship of God by Offerings." And this is an area where we can really begin to teach God's people. And we're going to talk about that much in detail coming up, because I believe that one of the biggest problems that Christians face is financial management. Especially younger Christians, but it's not limited to younger Christians. My wife and I recently spoke at an OPC family conference up in Northern California. It was interesting because I learned that I always thought that OPC stood for Only Perfect Church or Old People's Church, but I found out it means something else. No, we had a wonderful time with them. And I made the comment in talking to them that the good folks over at Barna have talked to and told us that in terms of the tithing of Christians in general, approximately 4% of Christians tithe anything. And one of the men said, "No, that can't be true. That just can't be true." And I said, "Well, you know, go look it up in your Funkin Wagnalls." And he did, and he wrote me afterwards, to his credit. He said, I just couldn't believe that was true. He said, "But I think Barna said it was between 4 and 5%. Okay, so I'll concede the percentage point. But what we're looking at is about 5% of those who call themselves Christians giving anything at all to the church. Now, here's what chapter 54 of the BCO says. 54:1 says this: "The Holy Scriptures teach that God is the owner of all persons and all things, and that we are but stewards of both life and possessions." That God's ownership and our stewardship should be acknowledged. That this acknowledgement should take the form, in part, of giving at least a tithe of our income and other offerings to the work of the Lord through the Church of Jesus Christ, thus worshiping the Lord with our possessions, and that the remainder should be used as becomes Christians. Isn't that an interesting way to end that section? That we ought to be giving a portion, a tithe. And I don't want to get in, don't ask me gross or net. Don't ask me that. If you have any question, just tithe. But the conclusion is, once you have done that, once you have given that to the Lord, giving back to Him a portion of how richly He has blessed us, the rest must be spent, ought to be spent, as befits a Christian. In other words, there are certain things that we cannot buy. There are certain things that we should not buy, because that is not becoming of a Christian. That's something that the deacons can teach God's people via Sunday school, via home visits. And I am a strong proponent not only of elder home visits, but also at times deacon home visits with either an elder or the pastor along in tow. The second part, the second section, reads this way. It is both a privilege and a duty, plainly enjoined in the Bible, to make regular, weekly, systematic, and proportionate offerings for the support of religion and for the propagation of the gospel in our own and foreign lands and for the relief of the poor. This is near genial in the way that the divines have worded this. Is every word is chosen specifically to express what they want to do. Our land, foreign lands, and for the relief of the poor. This should be done as an exercise of grace and as an act of worship. And at such time during the service as may be deemed expedient by the session. So the quality of stewardship then depends upon obedience to the master's will. It just boils down to being that simple. Our stewardship is one of the tests of life. It's one of living out what it means to be a Christian. And the question becomes, do we serve the Lord or do we serve mammon? Do we serve things? There's an interesting article by a man, I don't know his religious affiliation, if there is one at all. His name is Mark Regernus. And he wrote an article called Tracking Christian Sexual Morality in the Same-Sex Marriage Future. Now, obviously this isn't a talk about that. But what he does say in that are these words. Church-going Christians who support same-sex marriage are more likely to think pornography, cohabitation, hookups, adultery, polyamory, loving more than one person, and abortion are acceptable. And I would add to that list, they're also more likely to believe that you don't really need to tithe to the church, that you really don't need to do anything to give to the church. Now, let me just give you some of what I consider the basic, fundamental, rudimentary, elementary principles of biblical stewardship. First and foremost, and this is something that we have done at Grace in Yorba Linda, California, and I would encourage you to do in your own congregations. First, all things are made and sustained by God. And that's not reinventing the wheel. It's just a simple propositional truth. All things are made by God. All things are sustained by God. Everything belongs to God, including man. Second, God also gives and maintains human life as He sets man within His world. We often call this theologically providence, that God providentially takes concern over, governs, preserves all creatures, all their actions, all of His creation. Third, God decides when to terminate the life He has created. Psalm 90, verse 3 is very clear. I'll just refresh our memories on that one. That has to do with the Lord being the one who is in control of life. And we read in verse 3, "You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man." God creates man from the dust. God returns man to the dust. And in those two intervals, God is absolutely sovereign and in complete control over everything that goes down. Fourth, God determines upon the distribution of goods received by each during his or her lifetime. Probably the most familiar text that has to do with that is in the book of Philippians, where we're told to be content with God, with what God has given to us. And if we've attended seminary or we read any of the books at all, we are reminded of Jeremiah Burroughs' book, The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. And that's an important concept, especially in our time, because people are not content. We live in a day and age of entitlement. people believe that they can do whatever they should have whatever they want. People on welfare believe they should have a cell phone. People on welfare believe they should have a flat screen TV. People on welfare believe they should buy cigarettes and booze. That's their entitlement. And we live in that type of a culture. I live in probably one of the most image-conscious areas of the United States of America. There is more silicone and peroxide in Southern California than anywhere else in the world. Just down the road where my wife and I go and have breakfast once a week together at Newport Beach, California, there are more Mercedes-Benz per capita in Newport Beach than anywhere else in the world. I feel bad just driving my Cadillac. It's a 1950 Cadillac. That's it. So we teach God's people to be content with what they have, that God has entrusted into their care, and to do that joyfully because they know that God is in control. It's really self-idolatry to think that possessions come by our own earning and by our own effort. But many people do, even many within the Christian church, who will make the adamant point, this is my money, and I can do with it whatever I want. We are living in a day and age when teaching theology and teaching proper theology is of the utmost importance, because people have some of the worst theology in the world. We're probably more than acutely aware that not too long ago, Robin Williams committed suicide. When he committed suicide, the next day in our Southern California newspapers, I read things like this: he's in a better place. He's free now. He's smiling down on us all. He's told God and the angels a few jokes. None of that is true. He's at peace now? I'm not sure that's true. He's smiling down on us now? That's not even true of Christians. I know people get upset about that, but can you imagine? Here's a brother or sister in the Lord who dies. And we understand theologically that when, according to the way that our own shorter catechism summarizes it, the soul after death of the Christian is immediately in the presence of God. Do you think for one moment that the soul that is in the presence of the Lord God Almighty is going to take a little glance? Oh, what is he doing at my funeral? Oh, look, hey guys, how you doing? We need to teach this whole idea of God's sovereignty, God being in control of everything, because he's the creator, he's the owner, he's the master of all. God alone sets the requirements for stewardship of his goods and of the world. Now, if you have a pulse and you have dealt with people in the past and you talk to them about their finances, generally it boils down to this: well, we have a lot of bills to pay. And here's the way we work it. If there's any money left over at the end of the month, then we give that to the church. Most people in our society today, especially given the prevalence of plastic money, have too much month at the end of the money. And the solution to that is to put it on a credit card. In one of Rick Warren's books — Mr. Warren is just about a half an hour down the road from where I am — in one of his books, he described a person, fictitious character called Saddleback Sam, who goes to Saddleback Church. And here's what he said about Saddleback Sam. He has three credit cards that are maxed out.
He owns two cars that he cannot afford. And he's upside down in his house. He bought a house that at the peak cost $600,000 and it's worth $350,000 now. He can't unload it. Nobody wants it. He's stuck with it. But that's the way he lives. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. The revealed laws governing stewardship come to real expression in the Ten Commandments. And you might think, wait a minute, there's nothing in the Ten Commandments about money. Oh, yes, there is. There is a lot in the Ten Commandments about money. As a matter of fact, if you haven't ever thought of it this way, please try to think of the Ten Commandments this way. It is the ethical foundation for all of the Christian life. Try to conceive one of the Ten Commandments or any commandment in the New Testament that is not based on one of the Ten Commandments. How about the Eighth Commandment? And contrary to popular belief, the Eighth Commandment is not the one about smoking. The Eighth Commandment is the one about stealing, robbing. Can a person rob God? Well, I guess Malachi thought that they could. And the Holy Spirit, in inspiring Malachi, comes to God's people with a covenant lawsuit. And he says, one of the things is, you're robbing me. How can a person rob God? By withholding their tithe. By being a poor steward of all that God has entrusted into our care. Seventh point here is, to every steward, believer or non-believer, it doesn't really matter, does it? Everyone created in the image of God is called upon to be a steward. Whether you're, if you're a believer, fine, then that's, you understand that better. If you're a non-believer, you might not believe it, but it's true. God calls upon non-believers also to be a steward. So the question is not, am I a steward or am I not a steward? The question is, am I a good steward? Am I a biblical steward? Or am I a bad steward? Am I a self-centered steward? And then, it's also interesting that both stewards, good ones and bad ones, biblical and non-biblical, come to judgment. So the Bible opens with the days of creation in Genesis, and it closes with the day of judgment in Revelation. And between them lies for everyone the period of stewardship. So I want to now turn briefly to this, the concept of providing the congregation with sound biblical financial principles. 30-plus years of pastoral experience have driven the point home to me that many Christians are not good with finances. This applies to seminary professors. It applies to pastors. It applies to seminary students. And it applies to the man and the woman in the pew. No one is immune. I was at a meeting recently where a pastor of a large church in our area confessed to us all that for over 10 years, he and his wife vacillated between being in debt $80,000 to $100,000. $100,000 in debt. That's more than I make a month. That's a lot of money. But the good news was that by acquiring biblical principles, this pastor was able to pay that off. It meant tightening the belt, for sure. It meant living very differently. It meant discerning between that which is luxury and that which is necessity. And we are blessed here this afternoon to have a female in our midst. And I remember doing a marriage counseling one time in my study, and the husband and wife were there, and they were in financial trouble. And the man was giving me all of these reasons why they were having financial trouble. And I said to him,
have you ever talked to your wife about this? And he said, what would she know? I said, I don't know. So I turned to her and I said, what would you know about finances? And she opened her mouth. And you would have thought she was Warren Buffett. This woman was a walking encyclopedia of financial stewardship. And the guy looked at her and he said, I never knew that about you. And so I said to him as pastorally as I could, why didn't you know that? In part, in taking responsibility for the finances, it's not just that you're going to sit down and talk to the men about this. You need to talk to the men and to the women. True story, seminary, senior year in seminary, Byington Teaching Fellowship. I had reached the near apogee of my intellectual pursuits. And one of the professors asked us one day, he said, do your wives know where the insurance policy is? I wasn't sure what he was trying to get at with that question. But my conscience was immediately smitten because I didn't think my wife knew where it was. And so I went home and I pulled out the insurance policy, life insurance policy, and showed my wife where it was. And he also challenged us to have our wives do the bills for a month. Okay. So I asked my wife if she would be willing to do that. And she said, yeah, I think that would be a good exercise. At the end of that month, she said to me, could I do it for one more month? And I said, yes. At the end of that month, she said, could I do it for one more month? And I said, yes. And as the old saying goes, the rest is history. We do sit down, and we talk about our finances on a frequent, regular basis. I'm talking monthly. If God has entrusted the finances and the possessions we have, the house, the car, and everything else, if He has entrusted that into our care, I really believe, and I'm not trying to be extreme about this, I really believe that every dollar ought to have a name on it. I talked to a young man in the congregation just before I left, and he's got some financial woes. And his wife said to me, you won't believe what he did. And I said, what did he do? And she said, he went out and bought a game for his iPhone. It cost $100. And at first, I just couldn't even fathom the fact that there's a game for an iPhone that cost $100. But I suppose that there is. But I said to him, you can't afford that. Well, I just really wanted it. I said, no, but you can't. I understand. But you can't afford it. And that is to say that there are many things that we go in and we buy. The worst thing I say to my congregation, worst thing that could ever happen to me in life is, one, to win the lottery. That would be a miracle because I don't ever buy a ticket. But if I were to win the lottery, the worst thing after that would happen to me is for me to walk into Costco. Because I would buy everything I saw, even if I didn't need it. Oh, look, there's a mechanical tool set here. I just put that in the cart. All of these things. We need to be certain that dollars have their names on it. We are, and especially in our time, impulsive buyers. Impulsive buyers. The last time we were in Costco, I walked in, I saw something I wanted. I said to my wife, wow, I'd really like to have that. And she said, we have the money for it. If you want to buy it, you can buy it. So I thought, well, let me think about it. So I said, how about this? At the end of our time shopping, if I still want it, I'll go pick it up. And the more we walked around Costco, and the more I thought about that, and the more I ate the food that was out there, that takes forever. By the time we got ready to check out, I didn't want it. You can really have an impact upon people's lives. And I'll give you one realistic example. When I went to Toronto in 1984, probably about a year or so into my pastorate there, I noticed that there was a family that was receiving monthly checks from the deacons, and they had been doing so for 20 years. And so, just out of curiosity, I asked them, why is this family receiving this? Well, they don't have a lot of luxuries, which they didn't. They didn't own a car. They took public transportation. They had a rather large family. And so I said, well, how about we do this? How about if I and the shepherding elder and the deacon go out for a visit? So we arranged the visit, and we went out, and we were talking to the people. And so as we began to talk, I said to the wife, how much do you spend a month on groceries? And she said to me, I have no idea. I told you, just ballpark it. Give me a guesstimate. How much do you spend on groceries? And she said, I don't know. I have no clue. In the course of the conversation, I also discovered that the family, even though they didn't have a car, had cable. I also discovered that not only did they take a newspaper, but they took all three of the Toronto newspapers, all three of which were rags, but that's beside the point. I also discovered in the course of the conversation that Dad liked his adult beverage, and he would go through probably a couple of cases of beer a month. In Toronto, or in Canada, you cannot walk into a grocery store and buy alcoholic beverage. You have to go to a government-controlled store to buy it. A case of beer in Canada at the time was running about $25. And he was going through two. I also noticed that Dad was about a 2 or 3 pack a dayer. We began to tally all of this up. And I said to the wife, here's what I want you to do. Next time you go to the store, I want you to withdraw money from the bank, cash, and I want you to take an envelope and write across the envelope, groceries, and I want you to pay cash for what you buy, and I want you to put the receipt in the envelope. And the next time you go to the store, you pay cash, and you put the receipt in the envelope. And we came back, and now all of a sudden we have a barometer to understand how much they were spending on groceries. We told the brother, we don't pay for booze, we don't pay for your cigarettes. Cancel 2 of the 3 papers. I don't care which 2 you cancel. Cancel 2 of the 3 and cancel your cable. You would have thought that I had accidentally shot his grandmother. The guy went ballistic. But once he calmed down, we explained to him, well, this is part of financial responsibility. Long story short, 3 months later, they were still getting a ride to church, but not only were they not receiving diaconal support, for the first time in 20 years, they were tithing. This is, again, it's not rocket science, but it is more important in a number of ways than rocket science. So how do we come by this information about our congregants that they are struggling? Well, one of the ways is by the elders visiting them, and during those visits to understand, come to the comprehension that there is some kind of financial mismanagement. For the pastors in here, I will say this is a principle I've had in every congregation that I've served intentionally. I do not know who tithes what. I don't want to know. When we began to vet a list for potential elders or deacons, the question we have as a session is, does he tithe on a regular basis and is it proportionate? And if the answer from our treasurer is yes, we proceed. I don't want to know how much does he tithe, because we all know the pitfall of playing favorites, and money is very emotional, isn't it? Think about your own, if you're married, think about some of the discussions that you have had with your spouse about money. Have they ever become heated? As pastors, of course, We don't fight with our spouses. But my wife and I have had, on many occasions, intense fellowship regarding money and spending habits. But those things can be good, can't they? Because once we have those discussions, we may be charting, in the middle of that intense fellowship, we may be charting a new direction for our finances as God's stewards. Same thing can happen as the deacons begin to talk to the congregants about that. Whenever we talk to these people about this, let me say that the watchword for getting people back on track financially, as Dr. Whitmer has also alluded to in other aspects of visitation, is patience. We can suggest things that people need to do, but sometimes the actual crossing over of that threshold into what really needs to be done is something that's going to take a little bit of time. And it's going to require being a pastor, being a shepherd. It's interesting, isn't it, in Ephesians 4, that the word for pastor that's used by the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 4, 11 and 12 is the word for shepherd, poimenos. We are to shepherd the people. We are to lead them. I don't know if it's true, but I read in William Hendrickson's commentary a long time ago that the difference between a shepherd in Israel and a shepherd in the other countries is that the Israelite shepherd led the sheep and did not drive the sheep. But he also had that crook. And if you have a sheep, and we've heard that the sheep are not the smartest animals on the planet, maybe not even the second smartest animals on the planet, and one of the sheep is heading over, getting ready to walk off of a precipice, and you reach over with the crook and you grab the sheep by the neck and you jerk it back, the sheep probably won't look at you and say, "Thank you." The same thing can be true when we present the truth to God's people. In all likelihood, the first response is not going to be, "Thank you so much for telling me that my finances are out of whack and now I can't do whatever I want to do with my money." There's going to be probably a bit of a different response. So the deacon is to care for the poor in the congregation, where possible, outside of the congregation. And the deacons can be, and this has been our experience at Grace, in working together with the elders in helping the congregation to come to a better financial understanding. The way we have shepherding groups, each of our members is a member of a shepherding group. I very much appreciate the extra question that Dr. Whitmer wanted to have asked. I thought it was a fantastically interesting question. But where there is a need, the shepherding deacon will also go out with the shepherding elder for the home visits on a regular basis. What the deacon is supposed to be doing in terms of helping in this phase of financial management is a form of serving tables. It's exceptionally necessary in our time. And according to the BCO chapter 9, verse 7, the session can ask for, and the deacons can request, people with special gifts, male or female, not to be unordained deacons or deaconesses, but to serve with the deacon board. If you have someone in your congregation that is very, very good with money and is not an office bearer in the church, you might want to give prayerful consideration to bringing that person or persons on board to help you with these things. Now, I do have, and I'm just about out of time, I do have a number of these outlines. And I'm going to hold on to one. I want to just very briefly just take the top. This is something that my wife and I have gone through, and we've kind of put this together. We just called it the Ten Commandments of Family Finances, and let me run through those quickly. And then if anything else is unclear, you can ask at the Q&A. I have a monthly income expense summary that I think would be very helpful to sit down with your congregants if that are having financial difficulties and work through there, just line item by line item. How much are you spending? Why are you spending that? I heard a guy recently who was asked, how much do you eat out? In California, people eat out a lot. The guy and his wife were eating out on a regular basis every month, and they were spending $1,200 a month eating out. And he determined really quickly that that was his retirement. He was eating it every month. So here's what we came up with. We will strive for biblical perspectives on finance. This means that we will tithe 10%, save 10%, and spend the rest with thanksgiving to the glory of God. Ownership of material things will not be an issue in our home. Everything comes from God and therefore belongs to Him. It is therefore not mine, not hers, and not ours. As good stewards of God's resources, we will keep accurate records, use a budget to plan our financial commitments, and try to commit ourselves to living essentials. We will establish giving as a first priority in our financial affairs. We will establish covenants between us to develop accountability and a high degree of sales resistance. We will demonstrate our contentment with the things God provides by living within our means. We will not compromise our honesty or integrity for the sake of gaining more wealth. We will not allow money to become the top priority for our family, for God has promised to meet our needs. We will accept our responsibility to provide for our family's needs as we can reasonably anticipate them, and will trust God to protect us from unforeseen problems. We will concentrate our efforts towards establishing a spiritual rather than a material heritage for our children. And I will close there. I'll stop.